going to be so loud.
Okay, okay. Are you good? Amazing. How old is he?
He'll be 167.
167. He is an old man. Although his creator author has never in his works mentioned it explicitly, the detective's birthday is celebrated by fans all over the world on January 6th. We're releasing this episode on January 7th. Yesterday was January 6th, so happy birthday, Sherlock Holmes. Welcome to our podcast.
You're listening to the However Improbable podcast, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. We're reading them in the order they occurred in the lives of the great detective and his good doctor.
Holmes himself famously said that there's nothing new under the sun, but we're willing to give him a run for his money. I'm Sarah Kolb.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. This week, we're talking disguise, duped doctors, and deadly retribution. That's right, we're doubling up on the penniless doctors in this episode. It's the adventure of the resident patient. To listen to our audio adaptation of the story, go back an episode. We'll be here.
The Resident Patient was first published in the Strand in 1893, and it's found in the short story collection The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. It made Conan Doyle's list of his 19 favorite Holmes stories. I think it's maybe 18 on that list.
I think that's right.
According to Baring Gould's timeline, the story takes place in 1886. 5 years after Holmes and Watson met in A Study in Scarlet.
Though, and here's the weird thing, Resident Patient is a bit of a Russian roulette when it comes to reading it. Apparently, there are multiple versions out there in the world. In some, the story starts with Holmes' mind-reading scene from The Adventure of the Cardboard Box, which was added to this story after Conan Doyle decided Cardboard Box wouldn't go in the Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes.
So depending on which version of the story you read, Resident Patient either occurs in 1886 or right around the time of A Study in Scarlet. But we like it a little later, especially since Watson references both Study and The Adventure of the Gloria Scott, which we've already covered. And it reflects Conan Doyle's final decision.
So in Resident Patient, a doctor named Percy Trevelyan requests Holmes' expertise. After a Russian father and son visit his practice, Trevelyan's landlord, Blessington, fears someone has broken into their home. When Holmes investigates, he realizes that Blessington is keeping something from him, and he refuses to help any further. The next morning, it appears that Blessington has killed himself, but Holmes deduces a revenge plot. Blessington, previously known as Sutton, robbed a bank with several other men and, upon arrest, turned informer. So he basically turned his back on his fellow bank robbers. So the others were either hanged or jailed, and now, over 10 years later, they've been released and, in the guise of a Russian family, have come to enact justice by killing Blessington.
Percy Trevelyan is just like, you could be a faulty...
Percy Trevelyan. Oh, I love it.
Fawlty Towers character. Yeah, so before we dive into the story, here's what our narrator, Nathan, thought of telling the tale.
I was a big Holmes fan when I was in high school, which at this point was over a decade ago. I won't say how much over. I think the Holmes stories were maybe the first thing I ever read that was engaging to me, but not contemporary, and really opened up my world to literature, to things that had been written long ago, Jane Austen, Charlotte Bronte, Dickens, all that I was sort of willing to engage in because Sherlock Holmes was good and it was that old. So I do owe it that. It was exciting to get to delve back into that world, especially the bromance slash romance, depending on what theory you subscribe to, between Holmes and Watson, which was on full display at the beginning of this piece, that little exchange about Holmes basically being able to read Watson's mind. That's two men who love each other, certainly, whether romantically or not. That's love. Even though the mystery itself wasn't as fully fleshed out in this story as in a lot of the others, I really appreciated how very well drawn the characters of Mr. Blessington and Dr. Trevelyan were, given how little time Doyle has to establish them. That's a real skill of his, is just making those memorable characters so quickly, and that made it so much fun to bring them to life. So I hope you all enjoyed the story, and thank you so much for including me.
What did you think of this story?
I quite like it. It's, I think, a really tight little mystery. It's very neat. Everything that we learn from start to finish is really just in service of building up this mystery and then allowing it to become very clear what happened by the time that Holmes reveals everything. So I guess if you were to contrast A Study in Scarlet, in which in our discussion episode we talked about how it's not actually a very well-written mystery, this is sort of the exact opposite of that, where it is very nice, it is very clean cut and straightforward. I tend to think of mysteries, I don't know if this makes any sense, but really solid mysteries like this, they are almost, they feel mathematical to me, where it's like everything is just added up, and then when you get to the end, you can sort of divide everything neatly and see how everything slots together. It's very satisfying. Mm-hmm. What about you? What do you think of this story?
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, it's just a very tidy little mystery. And then there's this interesting backstory, and you see some of the themes that we've seen in Holmes stories already come up about people's past returning and vengeance and justice. But the thing I really like about it is it's a nice little mystery that's really exemplifying where Holmes and Watson are in their friendship and how well they're working together and what their life is like at this point in their relationship. Right. So the mystery, I mean, it's nice, it's interesting, but it's, for me, it's sort of secondhand to how they're working together to solve it and what their life is like.
We are 5 years gone now since they met each other, so that's a nice amount of time to really become close friends, where they've sort of worked out who each other are as people and what their relationship is going to be with each other beyond the fact that they are roommates.
Yeah.
So they're not just roommates who live with each other and who occasionally work together. It's really sort of moved past that
they're buds.
In this story.
Before we really talk about the plot of the story, I think we should talk a little bit more about this weird situation with its publication history and the fact that, so we aired one version of the story, which has the sort of added scene where Holmes kind of reads Watson's mind, is in it, it's included. We're not going to talk about it at length because you'll hear it again when we eventually get to the adventure of the cardboard box. And I think we'll talk about it there. It's a great scene and I love it a lot. So you get to listen to it twice. The more recently published version without this scene is slightly shorter, and it just sort of starts with Holmes and Watson are out on a stroll together. And then they come home and Percy Trevelyan's there.
Right.
So it really doesn't change the plot. It's just like a little extra dialogue.
There are, I think, three different versions. So the reason this came up, because I had no idea
about this
until, you know, we started reading it. And I have with me three different editions of the complete Sherlock Holmes, just because. And so I was reading, I have one edition that I have that I really like to read, especially for this podcast, is the edition that is reprinted to look like The Strand.
Mm.
So the text looks like The Strand, like the actual font, the way that it's laid out. It's got all of Paget's illustrations in it as well. It's very beautiful. So I like to read that one just to sort of, you know, get the illustrations and get the feel of what it was like for people to have read them when the stories came out. And so I was reading that one, and I think what happened was, I was like, I want to write this quote down. So instead of, you know, typing it out from hand, I went to Project Gutenberg to find their edition so I could just copy and paste it, and found that it was completely different.
Yeah, and you texted me, and you were then, like, what is going on here?
Yeah, and then I went to go check the other editions, and those were different from the other two, and I was like, what is going on here? So I think it's really funny.
It's really...
Conan Doyle.
Interesting mess. Yeah, I mean, if you've read the story before, you may have listened to a version that was slightly different than what you remember or not. I think what's telling to me about this is that, you know, there was this scene, and it's, again, like I said, a great little moment.
And Doyle mm-hmm. put it one place and then went, no, I don't want it here, and just, like, airlifted it into another story. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also funny just because of how much we've talked about the lack of consistency that Conan Doyle has, that he was literally like, oh, well, people have already read the story, but I'm still gonna just, like, slice and dice it.
Yeah, and that'll be fine. And no one will notice.
They're both good versions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make that much difference in terms of the plot,
yeah.
like we said.
Yeah, regardless, it's a story that gives us this nice little look at what these guys are up to in 1886. So Holmes is 32 and Watson's mm-hmm. 33 or 34. His age is a little more wiggly. So, you know, they live their lives a little bit since we first met them.
And something that I actually really do like about the Strand version is that Paget illustration of mm-hmm. them walking arm in arm with that stroll, because that is replicated in so many adaptations, I think. It's just a really nice little moment. And then, so I love to see it actually illustrated. It's very nice. But it gets to the idea of, like, what you were saying about their friendship really being the sort of thing that draws you in to the story.
And it's the first instance we have of Holmes and Watson taking long walks around London together. Mm-hmm. In Study in Scarlet, Holmes does this on his own to sort of help himself think, but now they do it together. And this, I really like this line where Watson's describing this. So he says, "For 3 hours, we strolled about together, watching the ever-changing kaleidoscope of life as it ebbs and flows through Fleet Street and the Strand." So that's just what they really do nice. For fun.
Yeah.
Which is lovely.
And you get this a lot in future stories where they sort of talk about, oh, you know, we're going out for a stroll, or we came back from a stroll, or, you know, to clear our minds, we just sort of went out together. And there's a lot of moments that I think are really nice when, I don't know how many times Watson actually says this happened, but it is so ingrained in my brain, where Watson talks about when they go for a stroll, sometimes they just won't talk and they just walk together. And it's just because, you know, he says, we walked in silence as only two people who are really intimate with each other can do.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really nice. It's not awkward silence. It's just, like, companionable, comforting
silence. Yeah, they're really comfortable with each other. They're just out there people mm-hmm. watching.
Right.
For fun.
Was it in Speckled Band we get this for the first time, that Holmes wakes Watson up by standing over his bed?
I think so.
So this is another story. In the few that we've covered so far, so it's really funny that this comes up again so quickly. This is another instance of Holmes waking up Watson by standing over his bed and opening the curtains on him, which is very funny.
I know. Going, all right, we gotta go. We've got a mystery. And this one, Watson mm-hmm. kind of goes like, oh my God, can I have breakfast first? And Holmes is like, no, have it later. Got stuff to do.
Rereading these, I'm like, oh yeah, this does actually happen quite a bit.
Often.
And it makes me think about the running joke in elementary about how Holmes constantly is waking Watson up, and it's just like the weirdest and most bizarre ways.
Yeah.
And she's kind of
dumping
just like
the turtle on her,
whatever, I guess.
Picking out her clothes for the day and tossing them on her while she's just like trying to take a nap. It's so funny.
Right. Like, come on, we gotta go. Let's go.
Yeah, that's very, very canon accurate.
It's great.
In around the time that we're recording this podcast, something happened, and there was this quote that caught my attention, written by John le Carré in Introduction to the New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. He died on December 12th, so, you know, a week or so before we're recording this podcast. He's sort of a titan of espionage, spy, mystery fiction. But he was also a mm-hmm. Holmes fan, and he wrote this really beautiful introduction to this book, which I went and found. And then it just was sort of fitting that we were talking about this story. It has such a focus on the importance of their friendship. So I thought I would read it. Holmes, mercurial, brilliant, complex, turbulent Holmes, is not safe out there alone. Oh, he manages. He can dissemble, go underground, disguise himself to the point where his own mother wouldn't know him. He can act dead or dying, trawl opium dens, wrestle with Moriarty on a cliff's edge, or dupe the Kaiser's spy. But none of that changes the fact that when he is alone, he is only half the fellow he becomes the moment faithful Watson takes back the tale.
That's so
I
nice.
I love that so much.
And we'll link that in our further reading so you can find the specific edition of Sherlock Holmes that he wrote the introduction for. What I really like about this is it talks about Holmes as an individual, and then it throws him in relief with his relationship with Watson. Like, it talks about, oh, he's entirely capable as an individual, but he just becomes something entirely else when he's with Watson. It's so lovely, and it really gets at what is so enduring about these stories,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
It's like, it would be fun, I guess, maybe to read about Sherlock Holmes just from a third-person, omniscient narrator, but I don't think these stories would have lasted if we didn't have both Watson's perspective and that relationship on which everything is hinged.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's an impressive person with all of these skills, mm-hmm. but his friendship with Watson humanizes him. Mm-hmm. And that's why we care. Yeah.
That makes me think of, this is slightly off topic, but only very slightly. There's this interview with David Duchovny about the X-Files.
I know exactly talking about, what quote you're
talking versions about. You do? Yeah, where he talks about Scully is Mulder's human credential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he says, like, Mulder's great and all, but Scully is really what makes him human and is what allows him to sort of function and
connects him to other people.
Like, the best, yeah, he can be. I mean, that relationship is basically Holmes and Watson, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's, like, literally that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about their professional relationship, because, again, things have slightly advanced from where we've last seen them.
Yeah, they're really doing stuff as a duo here. And it sort of in the setup to the story, Watson is talking about, he's publishing this one because he's always keeping an eye out for cases to publish that really show off Holmes's detective skills. And a lot of them are, they're hinged on something that's so minute it's hard to explain, or Holmes is doing something really, really fascinating inside his head, but there's not a lot of action, so they're not good reading. Mm-hmm. Or Watson thinks this one is kind of both of those things, and that's why he's chosen to write about it.
I really like that Watson having this sort of process of picking and choosing which stories to tell, because if you read between the lines, then that suggests how many other stories there are, how many other cases there are. And so you get both the sense that this is a constant thing where they're constantly engaging in cases, even if Watson isn't writing about them.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the fact that Watson is basically now a professional writer.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just a sort of, like, oh, this thing happened and it was interesting, or I wrote these notes down and I decided to make a story out of it. But it's very much a profession at this point.
He has, like, his systematic, these are the criteria for a good case that I'm going to publish. I'm not just going to do it because I think it's interesting. It's because I want you to think it's interesting. You, the reader.
I can imagine him having, like, a cabinet full of different files.
Uh-huh.
Of his notes, you know, of different cases, and just going through them and being like, no, not this one. Ooh, this one's interesting. Maybe I'll write about this one. Or I can't write about this one yet because that thing happened, so I gotta wait 10 years. And so it's really just fun to think about. I mean, I really love doing that reading between the lines with these stories. That's one of my favorite things about these, is how easy it is to imagine their life beyond what Watson literally writes down on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And then so you mentioned that they're really working in tandem in this story. What do you notice Watson doing here that he hasn't done before?
So I think his deduction skills have advanced a little, mm-hmm. as well as his storytelling abilities. Because there's this moment where he recognizes that it's, quote, he's sufficiently conversant with Holmes's methods to be able to follow his reasoning. There's kind of a moment where Holmes deduces something, and then Watson gets to explain to the reader how Holmes came to the conclusion rather than Holmes having to spell it out himself, which is a little bit of like a little humble brag. Like, I got it without him having to say it. Let me just spell that out for you, because now I can understand how he does this a little bit better.
And it, again, goes to show how smart Watson is, which I think is very much overlooked often.
Yeah.
Less now than I think before, but I think it's always worth reminding people that Watson is a smart person.
Yeah, he keeps up in his way.
Yeah. The other thing about their professional life is how imbued it is in their personal life as well. When we're talking about, oh, how's their personal life developed? How's their professional life developed? You can separate those things to a degree, but really they are so entwined and conversant with each other. this story, I think, is a really good example of that. They go and look at a dead body, and then they're back home by breakfast, and it's just...
That's just what they do. Is. Yeah.
Right.
Not in their day-to-day.
Right. Just like, oh, yeah, dead body. Oh, and let's go have some eggs. And then the other thing that I think is really interesting that I am still sort of parsing through in my own thoughts, because I think this is, like, a really complicated and weird habit that Holmes has, is that he brings clients into the home.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds very straightforward and direct, and, like, obviously he does that. That's what he's known for. I mean, when we think of Sherlock Holmes, we think of him in his living room, basically, sitting across from clients. I think what is really interesting about this is how he is bringing his work life into his domestic space and how representative that is of that entanglement, and how he is sort of interested in all of these, like, criminal or macabre or sinister things that are happening out in the London metropole, and how he is, like, literally cultivating them and bringing them into his home so he can sort of, like, revel in it. And he does that literally with objects sometimes, but I think also him bringing clients into his home is part of that. And I'm just really fascinated by that as someone who, you know, is considered a connoisseur of crime. And
yeah, I think that word collectibles, like, he's a collector of oddities. But in this case, oddities means people with weird stories who are coming to him.
Yeah.
For help.
Right, and he like literally sort of like collects those stories. Mm-hmm. And then Watson literally collects them.
Yeah, like literally by writing them down.
It's just it's fascinating to me.
It's really interesting.
The other thing that happens, we're just because we've been trying to track Holmes's traits and what we know about him and what we are learning about him through each story, is that Resident Patient is the first instance of this funny little trait that Holmes has when he's listening to clients, where he'll sort of like droop his eyes and like look like he is bored and not listening. Yeah, put his like palms
you can't
together
see us,
under
but
his
both,
chin.
Like, putting our hands.
Yeah,
in our
just like leaning back. And it seems like he is like falling asleep, but he's listening very attentively.
He's very iconic, like absorbing information pose.
Mm-hmm. Just taking it all in.
So here's this little line that Watson writes about Holmes, kind of early on in the introduction, that I really like. I just wanted to read. He loved to lie in the very center of 5 millions of people, with his filaments stretched out and running through them, responsive to every little rumor or suspicion of unsolved crime. Like, what an image.
That's great.
Yeah.
This is really a good line also. Yeah. And I think it does get back to that idea of Holmes wanting to collect all these experiences and all these strange things that are happening out amongst the 5 million people. And then you had another comment about something that we learned about Holmes.
Sort of
story.
Right after this is that he hates the outdoors. Like, he wants to be in the middle Holmes. Of a city where all of these people are bustling around. He was like, if you take me out into the country where things are boring on a vacation, I will die.
A topic that we have definitely touched on before, but which is certainly full force in this story as well, is this idea of justice and revenge and where our sympathies as readers lie.
Yeah.
Because this is another case of vigilante justice. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I know. We're like 3 for 4 in the stories we've aired.
Yeah,
so far.
I mean, because, okay, so you do have vigilante justice in Studying Scarlet.
Yeah, definitely right? In the Speckled Band.
It's unique in Speckled Band as Holmes is the one who is enacting the vigilante justice. And then this one, definitely.
Yeah, and interesting that, you know, we're 4 stories into mystery novels about crime, and the police have only really played a substantial role in the first one.
And the police are in this one, but they don't really do much.
They're kind of just there to, like, let them into a crime scene.
And they don't actually succeed in capturing the criminals either.
Yeah, again, not very effective.
I mean, the vigilante justice that is enacted in this story is that he has betrayed his fellow bank robbers, and they have escaped prison or have been released, and they've come back and said, like, hey, you're the reason we've been in jail for the past 10 years. That other dude is dead because of you. So, you get what's coming to you, basically. There's this really interesting line that says, quote, having secured him, it is evident to me that a consultation of some sort was held. Probably it was something in the nature of a judicial proceeding. So really framing Blessington / Sutton's murder as justice.
Yeah. And Holmes, he like figures this out by following the pattern of the ash on the ground. So these men are like all smoking their cigarettes, holding court outside of any sort of structure of the law, deciding what they should do with this guy. And they decide to kill him.
It's really interesting to me that phrasing of judicial proceeding, because it suggests that they're being really thoughtful about what they are doing, and that it's not just like bloody murder for the sake of murder. It is like you committed a crime and now you are paying for it. And in some, I mean, if you think about it, honestly, like, it's not as if Britain wasn't executing criminals. Mm-hmm. So these criminals doing literally what the law does and literally what the state does, it's sort of hard to blame them in a way. I get it, you know.
Yeah, I'd be mad. Yeah. And Blessington is not a sympathetic character at all. Even though he's the one who gets hanged, you're sort of like, oh, well, shouldn't have ratted it out, huh?
Right. And Holmes doesn't like him either, which I think definitely affects the way that we as readers feel about him.
Yeah, this is the first example of Holmes turning down a client. Holmes is like asking Blessington to be up front, and Blessington won't tell him the truth. And Holmes says, if you're not going to tell me the truth, I don't want to do this.
I think that's a good point, because I think if Blessington had told Holmes, Holmes wouldn't have turned him over to the police. He would have just helped him. So he sort of does it to himself in that way, where he secures Holmes' help, and then he actually doesn't let Holmes do his job. The only thing that I am really glad of is that the police don't capture the criminals. Because I think that would have been unsatisfying.
So Holmes solves the case. He figures out who Blessington was and why he was sort of put through this trial and killed, and that it wasn't really a suicide. Nobody gets arrested for this murder, and the murderers drown in a shipwreck.
I guess.
For some reason.
Yeah, they're on that ill-fated steamer on the Portuguese coast.
Sure, that one. I totally know what you're talking about, Watson.
Sure. Because, it's really convenient to sort of say, like, well, the police didn't get them, but, you know, it's been resolved because they all died. This is another example of the threat being excised from Britain. So, like, the literal geographic space of Britain. We've talked in the past before about all these imperial anxieties and the threat of degeneration and how that is sort of conflated with, like, foreignness. So, in Gloria Scott, even though Victor Trevor didn't do anything wrong, he still leaves Britain to go to Nepal because of his father's crimes.
Right.
And in this story, you have these criminals who are, they flee Britain and then are killed off the Portuguese coast.
Somewhere.
So you have all these instances of, like, the threat, whatever the nature of the threat may be, literally leaving the space of Britain, like, cleansing or purifying the space of Britain, which I think comes up in quite a lot of the stories in one way or another. Like, even with Speckled Band.
Yeah, Speckled Band is a really clear example. And that's where we've talked about this idea before. Mm-hmm.
That also complicates the thing that Holmes says about the law or justice, where he says, though that shield may fail to guard, the sword of justice is still there to avenge. If you're talking about the law here, he doesn't do that. If you're talking about vigilante justice, that does happen. But then these men are all killed again later.
Anyway.
So there's this sort of like complete ineffectiveness of any sort of justice, which is really interesting and odd.
Revealing Blessington's backstory, you have some sympathy with his robbing compatriots and then eventually his executioners because, you know, they were really screwed over by him. But it's almost like the narrative is saying, like, well, look, Blessington did something bad, so he's dead. And these guys did something mm-hmm. bad also, because first of all, they were in jail for robbing, and then they killed him, so now they're dead. So everybody's dead. Even though they got their justice for the slight against them, they still die anyway. Mm-hmm.
It's not unsatisfying.
No.
It's just odd. It's still, like we said, it's a good story, and I like reading this story. It's just strange when we think about this, like, longer thread or this motif of vigilante justice and what it's doing in each story. There's also this other moment that I don't want to pass by because it is, like, one of my favorites. Just speaking in terms of, like, what do we know about Holmes and what is unique about this case and the way that he treats this case? The morning after Blessington is killed, Holmes and Watson arrive back to his home, and upon learning that Blessington has committed suicide, or so he thinks, Holmes whistles. Low whistle, like, wow. Yeah. I think it gets to this idea of, like, Holmes's sense of humor. He is sort of admiring the strangeness of the circumstances, I suppose. I don't know. How do you understand that?
Yeah, I got it as sort of like, oh, well, now this is getting interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Or before it was just this old man who's super paranoid that some Russians are breaking into his room, but now there's a murder. Mm-hmm. So my time to shine.
And then the other thing about this case that is really interesting is Watson's writing of it, like the actual way that he deals with the case as a writer. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's this line, this is sort of right at the end, he's describing sort of as the wrap up, and there was some suspicion, like, a page servant young man let the robbers into the house. There's some suspicion about whether or not he was involved or how much he knew. But Watson writes, "The proceedings against the page broke down for want of evidence, and the Brook Street mystery, as it was called, has never until now been fully dealt with in any public print." So in publishing the story, it's obviously something that was sort of talked about, and he gets to reveal the truth to this strange happening. He's a little bit like a chronicler of true crime here, where he's like, oh, you all want to know the answer to this strange thing. Well, I've got it. I'm going to publish it. You can buy it in the magazine.
He does this in Speckled Band, too, mm-hmm. where he says, like, there were some suspicions around Grimsby Roylott's death.
Grimsby Roylott. Sorry.
And so he says, like, well, you know, Helen Stoner has died now, so I can tell this true story of what happened. But this one is treated differently. Like, it feels different to me, where Watson is like, breaking news.
A little bit, yeah. He's not keeping anyone's secret.
Right.
Everyone's dead. Mm-hmm. He's just sort of like, I've got the scoop. Here it is.
Yeah. And this seems much more public than the Speckled Band case was. Mm-hmm.
And a lot more immediate.
So there's a lot more chatter about it, I think, with the Brook Street mystery.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about how Holmes really likes the dramatic reveal. Watson's kind of doing the same thing here, just in print.
Oh, for sure.
Got a little bit of a shared sensibility in that way.
He's, like, taking notes on how to pull that off well. This story is also the first example of a client who really doesn't have anything at all to do with the mystery coming to ask them for help. So we have our young doctor, Percy Trevelyan, who, he's the doctor of the resident patient in question, who kind of, mm-hmm. he, like, gets stuff going, but then he's just doesn't do anything else. It's an odd structure for this tale.
He gets completely duped by the father and son mm-hmm. posing as Russians, who are really the criminals, and then he is really just, like, trying to come to terms with or, like, get through this weird situation of his landlord.
Yeah,
because
acting like a crazy man.
This guy came and offered me a space and money, and I was, like, a poor doctor, and so I said yes. And then all this weird stuff just happens, and he's like, I don't know what's going on. And then he's the one who gets tasked by Blessington to go ask Holmes for help. Then he just sort of completely moves to the side for the rest of the story.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you get introduced to him, and you're like, ooh, what's this guy got to do with it? Nothing.
Nothing.
He's just there.
Do So we've talked about quite a few of these things already, but I think it would be kind of interesting and helpful just to take stock of where we are 4 stories in and to look back briefly on the common themes and threads that we've been seeing in these first 4 stories.
Yeah. Lots of murder.
This was interesting to me. Unexpected, I think, for me. Because I know you've read them all through recently in this, you know, past year, but for me, I haven't read a lot of them for a while. I've reread a couple ones quite a few times.
Right.
Like, I've read Speckled Band quite a few times. I've read Sign of Four quite a few times. But I haven't just, like, sat and read through a bunch of the stories for fun recently. So having all these murders up front was like, oh, wow, these actually are kind of more bloody than I remember them being.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not gruesome, but they're still murder stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, just interesting. I mean, because they're totally out of order in the order that he was thinking about them or writing them, but they just sort of happened to be grouped where 3 out of 4 stories, somebody's died. Well, 4 out of 4 stories, I guess somebody's died, but I wouldn't call Gloria Scott a murder.
But maybe Hudson is killed.
That's true.
I'll be really interested in, like, going forward to see how many murders we end up having in a row.
Yeah, I know. I've got to, like, count.
Because I think your point about, you know, going chronologically is really interesting because it suggests that there were a lot of murder investigations in those early years with Holmes and Watson, which really up the stakes, I think.
Yeah. Or at least that's what Watson is choosing to write about.
True.
Kind of earlier in their detective career.
Revenge, another big,
theme. Yep, people's pasts coming back and impacting the lives that they're leading.
Justice being enacted beyond the law, either by Holmes or by criminals. I've seen a lot of that. And then, like I said, the threat being exported abroad, like, not dealing with this in Britain, sending it out for others to deal with.
Interesting.
Not a lot of women so far, actually.
No. This is another story. There are no women.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, because I think of women as so integral to the stories, and we really haven't seen that many big players besides Helen Stoner. So, Sarah, were there any adaptations that you looked into for this week?
Not a ton. Bert Cool's radio adaptations for the BBC, which are really, really charming and lovely.
Worth listening to.
They did this story in 1992. And then the real big one that I wanted to talk about is the Granada Holmes episode, which is episode 4 of season 2. It's so good.
So David Burke.
With David Burke as Watson. Yes.
It's good.
It's so charming. And I think it exemplifies a lot of what we've been talking about, where there are just these, like, lovely little added moments in between Holmes and Watson that are so great.
I love that opening scene.
Yeah, right, yeah.
When they're in the barber shop and Holmes is sitting there next to Watson, who's getting his hair cut, and Watson's trying to deduce why Holmes has left Baker Street to join him in the barber shop. And he gets it wrong, of course, and then they have a little laugh about it. And then you have that really nice moment of them replicating the Paget drawing where they're walking arm in arm back to Baker Street. And I think one of my favorite moments is when they stand outside of Baker Street and are looking at that carriage, and they both get to do a little bit of deducing. And it's very, like, it's like banter.
Yeah.
You know, it's very playful.
Yeah, they're like, oh, it's a doctor's carriage. Oh, I bet he's upstairs and he wants to talk to us. Oh, it's a good thing we came back. Like, they're just in their groove. It's so good.
It's really nice. And I think what that episode does that is really interesting is actually the very, very beginning of the episode when Blessington has that nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
It's very weird. Mm-hmm. It's really weird. So he has this nightmare and he goes downstairs and he, like, sees his body in a coffin or something. Then he, like, wakes up and it's so bizarre.
Yeah, he's, like, foretelling his own demise.
And then I think the other big standout scene is the investigation after Blessington's murder. When Jeremy Brett gets to, like, crawl around.
And, yeah, he does a lot of
deduce.
Exemplary physical acting, which for Holmes, in particularly in these early stories, it really involves like climbing on furniture and wiggling around on the floor looking Love at it. Ash and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're going to talk about this more in the future, but one of the things that is so unique about Jeremy Brett's Sherlock Holmes, at least up to the point, you know, when they were making Granada Holmes, is how active he is. And I know Jeremy Brett has, like, noted before Holmes' weird or odd physical traits that he has, where he is, like, he likes to wiggle, and the way he sits in chairs mm-hmm. is funny, and that's what makes him such a full character.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Brett just excels at making Holmes this sort of, like, odd man who, you know, has all these little quirks.
Yeah, so that one's right? worth watching.
This week, instead of our usual read-alike book recommendations, we wanted to do something a little different. In light of John le Carré's death and his really prolific career, we wanted to recommend him instead. So, Sarah, I would ask you, do you have any recommendations for le Carré?
I do. I have a couple favorites. Stuff that it's been a couple years since I've read these, and I kind of want to go back now that I've been thinking about him, but Call for the Dead, which is a 1961 novel, is a favorite. And then his sort of really iconic one, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, which he wrote mm-hmm. in 1974, which that one's definitely sort of my favorite and I think exemplifies the kind of really good storytelling and just like interesting plots that thread together and interesting characters and tension and drama. That's mm-hmm. the one I would recommend people start with. And I think it might be, other than maybe The Spy That Came in from the Cold, it's probably his most famous too.
I also wanted just to recommend, in terms of, like, if you are interested in digging more into the weirdness of the publication
oh, yeah.
history, a book that I found was called The Sherlock Holmes Companion, An Elementary Guide by Daniel Smith, that I used to sort of understand what the publication history was of Resident and Patient. So that was quite helpful. Oh, and we should mention also that the introduction that we read at the top of the episode is from the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, edited by Leslie S. Klinger, with an introduction by John le Carré.
Yeah, I kind of want to buy a copy, even though I have multiple copies of these stories know, already, like, but I love this writing about these stories so much, I almost mm-hmm. want to get it. I think it's in three parts, and we'll put those books in our bookshop, so if you want to buy them mm-hmm. for yourself, you can find them on our website. Join us next week, rather than in 2 weeks, for a special Case File episode about a Sherlock Holmes film like no other. And the week after that, we will air the story, The Adventure of the Noble Bachelor. And special thanks to our narrator, Nathan Comstock. You can send your thoughts to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @improbablepod. If you have a favorite John le Carré book that's not one of the ones I mentioned, let us know. I'd be interested. I need to do some rereading. It's been a long time. Our website is howeverimprobablepodcast.com, and you can find transcripts, the research behind the episode, suggestions for further reading, links to our bookshop, all that good stuff. If you enjoyed the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
Another quick note is that we will now have content warnings in our show notes for both the story episodes and the discussion episodes. So please do check those out ahead of time. If you have any thoughts, or if we miss anything in terms of content warnings and you would like us to add something, please just let us know. We are also going to go into our backlog of episodes we've already published and add content warnings to those as well. However Improbable is created by Marissa McHiro and Sarah Kolb, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.